can start. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, everybody. Please.
Where are we reading? Rosa? Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes.
No.
Yes, we read about the city of lapis lazuli and pearl, didn't we? Line 238 on page 421. We were reading about Narad's mind and how that mind communes with the powers that build the worlds until through the shining gates and mystic streets of the city of lapis lazuli and pearl, proud deeds step forth, a rank and march of gods. It's quite a mysterious sentence. But before that, earlier on last week, we read about Gandhamadan, where the Apsaras roam. So both Patty and I did some research on this mountain. Here, according to the Puranic Encyclopedia, it says that it's a mountain famed in the Puranas, in the ancient stories, and it lies to the east of the Himalayas. And there's a list of incidents, important Puranic incidents that have happened on that mountain. But it is said that only those who possess power got by tapas, people who have performed austerities, will be able to climb this mountain. So one has to have some realizations to be able to climb it. So that suggests that it's a mountain, not a physical mountain, but an inner mountain. And Patty found out something different. Can you share with us, Patty?
I just looked it up on the internet. So there was a slight variation of the name. It was Gandhamadan. But it was said to be a hill in Odisha. It was presently in Odisha. It's known for medicinal plants. But the name literally means intoxicating with fragrance.
So that has something to do with it. Yeah. Lovely. All wonderful perfumed plants and medicinal plants grow on that hill.
Is there anyone from Orissa here? No. Or anybody who knows Oriya? I wondered if that's a standard variation to add the R in there.
Not today.
So because Gandhamadan is the Sanskrit, so would that be natural in Oriya language to add an R in that?
It's not in the language, it's not in there. In Hindi, Bengali, we understand.
That R you're saying is there. So in Savitri it's been left out, but anyways. Okay.
It's also left out here.
What's an R within France?
Okay, so let's go on. Shall we start on this side today? We can even start at the back. We can start with Praveen.
Following causes of our human life, earth keeps for man some short and perfect hours. When the inconstant sweep of time continues, the eternal moment which the deathless lips get clear that touch upon the mortal's world. Hardly a soul and body here are closed. Is a fierce, difficult movement of the stars, whose life can keep the paradise alone. Its rhythm repeats many toned melody, tirelessly throbbing through the rapturous air, caught in the song that sways the Apsara's limbs when she floats gleaming like a cloud of light, a wave of joy on heaven's moonstone floor. Behold this image cast by light and love, a stanza of the ardor of the gods, perfectly rhymed, a pillared ripple of gold. Her body like a brimmed pitcher of delight, shaped in a splendor of gold-colored bronze, as to see earth's truth of hidden bliss.
Thank you. We should just remind ourselves of the context of these lines. Narad has somehow welcomed Savitri, and he has asked about her, and yet when he stops speaking, there's some doubtful note, which Asvapati, with his observing, wise, calm mind, he notices that. And he feels that behind the words there's a threatening shadow. But he doesn't get disturbed. He's a person who doesn't get disturbed. So he answers Narad in a very careful way. He doesn't... Narad has not spoken out his knowledge, and Asvapati also wants to speak cautiously. And very politely, first he speaks about Narad himself, his wisdom, the capacities, his achievements. And that's what we finished last time. Now, there's a transition to something else. Asvapati says there are magical moments, pauses of our human lives, even here on earth, when we can experience some short and perfect hours that seem to be beyond time in some way, when this inconstant tread of time, I suppose the tread of time is inconstant because it varies a lot. Sometimes time seems to be running, and other times it seems to be going very slowly, and it's unpredictable. We can't really tell why time should behave like that. But there are these special moments when even our time, our earth time, seems like the eternal moment which the deathless live, the eternal now which is experienced by immortal beings. But he says that only happens very rarely. It's very rare that a body and soul are born here on earth in this fierce, difficult movement of the stars, all the toil and effort that's going on in the material universe. It's very rare that any being can be born whose life can keep that paradisal note, that touch of paradise, of perfection. A person whose soul and body repeat that many-toned music which is always resounding in the immortal spheres, and which is caught, he says, in the song that sways the apsara's limbs. We spoke about the apsara's last time. The heavenly dancers, they are dancing to a wonderful rhythm, a paradisal note. And when the apsara dances, she floats, gleaming like a cloud of light, a wave of joy on heaven's moonstone floor. So it's a beautiful image of those divine dancers who express in their dance all the love and delight and beauty of the higher realms. But then Asvapati points to Savitri. He said there are very, very few people who can keep that paradisal note. But look at her, this image, Savitri, like a projection of light and love. She's like a poem which expresses the enthusiasm, delight of the gods. She's so perfectly formed, perfectly rhymed, like a perfect poem, but also just like a pillared ripple of gold. So straight, upright, with very beautiful curves. Her body is like a pitcher, a jug or jar, which is full to the very brim with delight. And it's shaped in this lovely golden color, this gold-colored bronze, as if to seize, to get hold of and to contain Earth's truth of hidden bliss. When we see Savitri, we remember that the real truth of this world of material forms is a hidden bliss. It's bliss, but we don't usually see it. But in a perfect form like that of Savitri, we can catch a glimpse of it. So with this, Asvapati is going to continue until the middle of the next page, a wonderful description of Savitri, how he sees her, what she means to him. Eric, you'd like to read?
Dream mates, ill-humanized mirrors are her eyes, draped suddenly in a slumberous fringe of jet, retaining heaven's reflections in the depth. Even as her body, such is she within, heaven's lustrous mornings gloriously recur, like drops of a fire upon her silver face, in a young spirit yet untouched with years. All beautiful things, eternal, seen and new to virgin wonder in her crystal soul. The unchanging blue reveals its spacious soul. marvelous the moon floats on through wandering skies. Birds, flowers, spring up and love at time and death. The charm mutations of the enchanter life race like bright children past the smiling hours.
Thank you. We're on page 422, and Eric just read line 258 to 271. His lines are full of beautiful, evocative pictures. And
you want to meet her?
You want to meet her, yes. But anybody has anything they would like to ask about any of these lines? Yes, the charmed mutations of the enchanter life. Life is like a magician who is always showing us changing scenes and forms. Things change in a delightful, magical way. That's how Savitri sees, how she experiences life, because of the purity of her inner being. So all these charmed mutations. It's like a crowd of children running. So he's spoken about her body, her eyes, but also about her inner being, which is so receptive to the beauty of the world, to the higher aspects of the world. You'll read, Patricia?
If but this joy of life could last, nor pain throw its bronze note into her rhythmed days. Behold her, singer with the prescient gaze, and let thy lesson chant that this fair child shall pour the nectar sorrowless life around her from her lucid heart above. Feel with her bliss the tired breast of earth, and cast like a happy snare felicity. As grows the great and golden bounteous tree, flowering by Alakananda's murmuring, where with enamored speed the waters run lisping and battle to the splendor of morn, spirit left around the knees of heaven's daughters, dripping magic rain, pearl bright from moon gold glitterings and cloudy air. So are her dawns like jeweled leaves of light. So casts she her felicity on men. A flame of radiant happiness she was born, and surely will that flame set earth alight. Doom surely will see her pass and say no word.
Thank you. You want to ask about Alakananda?
It's here in the book. I don't remember about it.
It's one of the tributaries of the Ganga. But the real allusion here is not to the river, but to the tree, the Kalpavriksha, the bounteous tree, the tree that gives, that fulfills wishes and gives blessings. The great and golden bounteous tree which grows by the banks of that river. And Asvapati makes a lovely picture of it, you know, that there's the beautiful tree, and bathing beneath the trees are the Apsaras, heaven's daughters, dripping golden rain. So it's a really lovely picture, the golden leafed tree, the dance, the bathing heavenly nymphs, the water full of light. So he says, Savitri's mornings are like that, full of that jeweled light. And in the same way as that great and golden bounteous tree, she is spreading her quality of happiness. So that's what he wants to last. He thinks that, he feels that Savitri has been born with that special gift of spreading happiness. So that's why he's asking Narad to give this blessing, that there doesn't have to be any suffering in this life. He says she's born like a flame of radiant happiness, radiating in all directions, and surely that flame of delight has the power to fill the whole earth with delight. So any kind of misfortune, doom that is there will not be able to touch her. This is his wish and his hope. And he wants to have Narad's confirmation of that.
I think Sri Aurobindo says that Ashwapati's palace is located on the Alakananda.
Yes? So where does he say that?
I thought I read that somewhere, either in Deshpande or in this. I have to see if I can find it. But anyway, that river has the speciality of being the one through which is supposed to have run through Shiva's hair. Therefore, that's the one that brings down the divine love on the earth.
That's
where? Part about Shiva's hair is in this dictionary. But I had read that story.
Yeah, of course there's this descent of the Ganges. And it's so powerful that it will... it's purifying, but it will purify the whole earth. It will wipe it out. So Shiva stands there and receives it in his hair so that it trickles down.
The word hair, at least in my thing, tresses.
Tresses.
Which imply
length. Yeah. Yes, the long hair. so that the Ganga can come down and bring blessings to earth. So I suppose all these major tributaries, the Alakananda, the Bhagavati, the other ones, that these are streams of the Ganga. I think there are four main tributaries that come.
And was there in Ganga, the Bhagavad Gita describes with Ganga is a power, vital power, the plasticity and adaptability in every situation. Very interesting. Thank you.
There's a whole long story in the Mahabharata about how it happens that Ganga has to come down like this.
There's a very, very small book, old book. There's an incredible story about that. It's a very old book. I was in the beginning when I came to it. It's very interesting. There are 1,000 million names, incredible.
So that's how he feels, that doom surely will see her pass and say no word. But he realizes that there's another possibility also. Alice, would you go on?
But too often, here the careless mother leaves her children in the envious hands of fate. The harp of God falls mute. Its call to bliss, discouraged, fails mid earth's unhappy sounds. The strains of the siren ecstasy are not here, or soon are silenced in human heart. Of sorrow's songs, we had enough. Bid once for glad and grateless things, bring heaven here. Or must fire always test the great of soul, along the dreadful course of the gods, honored with love and faith and sacred joy, a traveler to the eternal house, once led, unwounded. Path, a mortal.
Thank you. But he acknowledges that it seems that sometimes it happens, seems to happen, that the chosen ones who are supposed to help and uplift and bring light, that dreadful things happen to them and they can't continue with their work or their song. He says the strings of the siren ecstasy cry not here, or soon are silenced in the human heart. So we had a reference to those griefless daughters of heaven. This is a reference to Western mythology, to Greek mythology, the sirens. And it's very interesting that here Shobindo brings out a deeper symbolic significance of these sirens than we are used to. I mean, Homer doesn't bring that out in his telling of the story. It,
they occur in the Odyssey, the story of Odysseus, Ulysses, on his long journey back to his homeland of Ithaca after the fall of Troy. And he's somehow angered the god of the sea, so he gets all kinds of dreadful disasters on his journey home, and it takes him 14 years to get back to his home island from Troy. And so the whole story of the Odyssey is full of these marvelous stories. This is one of the episodes. He is warned that he will have to pass by some rocks where the sirens sit and sing. And in modern Italian, this word means a mermaid. Anyway, they're supposed to be so beautiful. The sirens, they sit and they comb their long golden hair, and they sit on these rocks and sing. And here it sounds as if they've got instruments that they sing to. And the characteristic is that if you hear them, if a sailor hears them, they simply can't resist leaping into the water and getting dashed against the rocks, getting destroyed. So Odysseus is such a clever fellow. He wants them all to reach home safely, but at the same time he wants to hear that wonderful song. So he instructs his sailors to put wax in their ears. And he doesn't get any wax in his ears, but they have to tie him strongly to the mast. And he says, whatever happens, don't set me free. Whatever I do or anything, you keep me bound there until we're well past these rocks. So that's what they do. So Odysseus, this is one of his special characteristics. There are symbolic aspects to this story also. That he is the one who has heard the siren's song and has not left this world. So I don't know, there was a great teacher in the ashram, Medananda. We have many of his works here in a talk, an early talk of the 60s. He has mentioned that, I have understood what is the song of the sirens. He said, it is the call of eternal bliss. And if you hear that song, it's irresistible. But the trouble is, you will have to leave this world now then. So here Sri Aurobindo has brought out that deeper sense. He says this song of the siren ecstasy, it doesn't, we don't hear it here. There's a reason why we don't hear it here. Or if we hear it for a moment, it's soon silenced. That attraction of the infinite and the eternally blissful. But in any case, what Aswapati is doing is that he's asking for Narad's blessing for a griefless life for his daughter. Of sorrow songs we have enough. So please, you with your special voice that has the power of making things come true, bid once, give the command that Savitri's glad and griefless days will bring heaven here on earth. But then he asks, but is it the case that always the great of soul must get tested, must pass through some painful ordeal? He hopes not. The dreadful causeway of the gods. This is that narrow passage through
the material universe that each soul has to pass. No? He says she's armored with love and faith and sacred joy. So please give your blessing that she'll be able to pass unwounded, that she won't have to suffer like the rest of us do on our journey to the Eternal's house. This is his request.
I'm actually surprised that Ashok Pati, I think it shows that out of attachment, he had forgotten his yogic knowledge, because we've read all the things he's been through, he's seen all the worlds of being and all that. But still he doesn't think like this, you know?
He had prayed for an incarnation of the Supreme Divine Mother to bring down her force and her bliss on earth. He thinks that's Savitri's mission. And of course she's his daughter and he adores her. So he wishes she may have a griefless life, not just for her own sake, but he says so that she can cast that happiness on everybody else and set earth alight like that. But he accepts the possibility that there might be something else.
And you cannot say he could know that.
he should know better.
They should.
Yeah. Yeah. No, later on he asks Narad, we will see in Canto 2, he says, when it's all been laid out, no? He says, but I believed that a great power came with her, and isn't that great power that she's carrying, isn't it stronger than fate, than this earthly doom? So Narad gives a very interesting answer to that question. We won't anticipate it now. Mm-hmm. But what is interesting is that in his telling of the story in this way and this deeper significance that he's given to it, he has given this special role to Savitri's mother, which again we will see in Canto 2. That Aswapati says something here, but it's Savitri's mother who really accuses and complains and says, how can it be? And forces Narad to answer her. So we'll come to that.
That is another curious thing, because he calls her wise, and then she goes into the...
No, he says, even though she was wise and calm and Aswapati's queen, still she opened her doors to grief. No? And then she started to accuse.
Do you want to be back to
this? No, I'm just saying it just shows the human nature.
Yeah, he does. Because Sri Aurobindo wants to answer our human nature. No, through Narad, he gives at least a partial answer, the beginning of an answer about the problem of pain. The final answer comes later. It comes in Book 10, Canto 4. But here in Book 2, Book 6, Canto 2, there's an answer to the way of fate and the problem of pain. Why does it have to be like this? And that is the last book that Sri Aurobindo worked on before he left us. He was working in Book 6, Canto 2. So that's his prayer. Once let unwounded pass a mortal life. Tara, you read.
But Narad answered not. Silence, he said, knowing that words have been and fate is Lord. He looked into the unseen with seeing eyes, then dallying with the mortal's ignorance like one who knows not
questioning his time. On what high mission went her hastening heels? Whence came she with this glory in her heart and paradise made visible in her eyes? What sudden God has met, what face supreme? To whom the king, the red Ashoka, watched her going forth with malices were returned. A vision into an air of flaming dawn, like a bright bird, tired of her lonely term, to find her own Lord. Since to her of earth he came not yet, his sweetness wandered forth, leaving her way with the beast of her wretched wings. Left by a distant call, her vague swift flight, dreaded the summer warmth and sunlit lands. The happy rest her burden left his feet, and his charmed garden lifts whole treasured still. Virgin who comes, perfected by joy, reveal the name thy sudden heart beats learn. Whom hast thou chosen, kingliest among men?
Thank you. Oh, he doesn't reply, except with a question, pretending that he doesn't know. Where has she been? Where has she come from? Who has she met? And the king says, we don't know. She's been away for a year. The red Ashoka, it's a tree which flowers in the summer, watched her going forth, which now sees her return. And off she went like a bird one morning to find her life partner, because he didn't come to her. So, following some distant call like a bird, she has set off. And he says, the rest, she hasn't told us yet. It's there somehow in her eyes, and she hasn't spoken anything out yet. So he asks her, her father asks her, reveal the name thy sudden heartbeats learned. Whom hast thou chosen, kingliest among men? So her parents are relying entirely that she will make the right choice, and whoever she's chosen, it must be the right person, because they feel that she has that power of inner guidance. This Ashoka, the name means no grief. No grief. No sorrow. Ashoka. Savitri answered. Yeah.
Bhakti answers with a still calm voice and one who speaks beneath the eyes of faith. Father and King, I have carried out thy will. One whom I sought I found in distant lands. I have obeyed my heart, I have heard its call. On the borders of a gleaming wilderness, which shall have giant hills and brooding woods, he has crashed her charge. We must stay in our dwells. Blind, exiled, outcast, once a mighty king. The son of Vimasena Satyavan, I have met on the wild forest's lonely world. My father, I have chosen. This is done.
Thank you. So it's only 18 lines or 19 lines, but she's told the whole story. It's clear. Shall we go on?
Yes.
Will you read?
Astonish all sad silent prospects. Then Ashwapati went to the cave and saw a heavy shadow float above the end, chased by a sudden and splendid light. Looking to his daughter's eyes and spoke, "Well, had thou done, and I approved thy choice. If this is all, then all is surely well. If there is more, then all can still be well. Whether it seems good or evil to men's eyes, only for good the secret will come forth. Our destiny is written in double terms. Through nature's contraries, we draw nearer to God. Out of the darkness, we still grow to light. Death is our road to immortality. Cry, world, cry, world. The world's lost voice is ready. Yet conquers the eternal good at last."
Thank you. So with his inner sight, he sees a shadow over Satyavan's name, but that shadow is chased away by a sudden and stupendous light. So he gives his blessing. I approve thy choice. He doesn't object that Satyavan's father is blind and exiled and outcast and living in a forest. He approves. If this is all, then all is surely well. And even if there's more that we don't see, it can still be well. He expresses that whether our human idea of things tells us that it's good or bad, the divine will can really only work for good. And our human destiny is written in these double terms of good and bad and this and that. Through the contraries, the oppositions of nature, we grow nearer to God. We grow out of the darkness towards the light, and even death, it's just a step which takes us nearer to immortality. So people may complain, cry, woe, the world's lost voices wail, yet conquers the eternal good at last. That's the conclusion that he has come to.
What do you read?
Then when the page had spoken, but the king in haste broke out and said the dangerous word, O singer of the ultimate ecstasy, lend not a dangerous vision to the blind, because by native right thou hast seen clear. Impose not on the mortal's tremulous breast the dire ordeal that poor knowledge brings. Demand not now the Godhead in our acts. Here are not happy peaks the heavenly throne, or coils or a bright point of starry stair. Abrupt, jagged hills, only the mighty climbs, are here where few dare even think to rise. Far voices call down from the dizzy rocks, chill, slippery, precipitous are the sun. To hide the gods are with man's fragile life. In their large heavens they dwell exempt from fate, and they forget the wounded feet of man. His limbs that faint beneath the whip of grief, his heart that feels the tread of timeliness. The future's road is hid from mortal sight. He moves toward the veils and the secret things.
Thank you. So what's happening here? Aswapati stops Narad from speaking. He doesn't want him to tell the future, because that's such an ordeal for us, so difficult to bear for knowledge. And he reminds Narad, he says, you live up there in Vaikuntha, in Vishnu's heaven. Or there's also Kailash, the heaven of Shiva. But it's not like that down here. No, here it is different. Here we have, in order to achieve some higher vision, great strength is needed, and very few people are able to make that effort, and it's very dangerous on our human mountains, these earthly mountains. There are voices calling us to, we tend to fall down, or to attract us to fall down. The paths are icy, slippery. The gods are too hard on us. They forget how breakable, how weak, and how fragile we human beings are. They forget how much suffering human beings have to go through. You, Narad, you can see the future, but to us human beings, the future's road is hidden from our sight. Human beings move towards the future's face is veiled and secret. There's a reason for that. Here in line 365, I think we have a remnant from earlier versions of the poem. When Shobindo first started writing this poem, so far as we know, in 1916, he used a way of transliterating the names, which was something like something close to Bengali. So he spelled Aswapati. He called him Uswapati, with a TH and a Y at the end. And even when he changed the U at the beginning to A, he kept that TY at the end for some time. It was only in the final version that he changed it to TI, Aswapati, which is closer to Sanskrit. Aswapati, it's the lord of the horse. So similarly with the names of Satyavan and Savitri, they were kind of archaic spellings. So it looks a bit like that here. Instead of writing Kailash as we are used to seeing it, he has written Koilas and Vaikuntha with this OU in the middle. So these are the heavens. Prasad, you'll read?
To like one step in front is all his hope. And only for a little strength he asks to meet the riddle of his short, shrouded fate. Awaited by a vague and off-seen force, aware of danger to his unseen powers.
Uncertain.
He guards his flickering warnings from her breast. He feels not when the dreadful fingers close. Around him, with the grasp none can reach. She though comes lose her grip, will only speak. Perhaps from the iron snare there is escape. Our mind perhaps deceives us with its words and gives the name of doom to our own choices. Perhaps the blindness of our will is fate. He said, and Narad answered not a thing.
Thank you. It's as if fate is lying in wait for all of us. But she's shrouded, she's covered, we don't see her. We need just a little strength to be able to. We don't ask to see in advance, no? Just for a little strength. If we can light just the step in front, that's the most we can hope for. And yet, we all have this feeling that something dreadful can always happen. And so we try to protect our little wishes and our hopes like a candle in a storm, flickering. And the breath of fate can blow out our flickering hopes, yearnings. At any moment. And when fate gets hold of us, we don't We don't feel it, we don't even know it now. So as Vapati tells Narad, if you have the power to unloose that grip of fate by speaking, then please do it. And let us know so that we can take whatever precautions or steps are necessary. But otherwise, please don't let us know. Don't tell us. Better not to know. Yes. Well, it's not really bliss, but it's a kind of protection, isn't it? That's what you say. Yeah. But still, when we know something very bad, we tend to want to protect the people that we love, no, that we wouldn't like to share these things with them.
The real freedom is to look it right in the eyes, and then you get the bliss. We're still free from the attachment to the adult. He's trying to tell Narada what to do, fix things nicely for us.
Yeah, that's what we want to do. Yeah. No, we would like to have things nicely fixed.
But in the previous talk, he says, oh, everything will be fine. So he's varying back and forth between the ignorance and
so who will read on? I don't know your friends. Will you read? Yes.
The smell which came around with her voice. All clear. Thy bright arrival as in time. These high moments of happy life. Then let the speech be new.
Benign.
Of useless tears confirms this blithe.
It's the same I, blithe, yeah.
Blithe, conjunction of two stars, and tension joy with thy celestial voice. Here, blood not lit the light of our earth. Let not our words create the dim they fear. Here is no cause for bread, no chance for grief, to raise her ominous head and stare at love. A single spirit in a multitude, happy in such a bond with earthly men, in the sadity of freedom for a man. And fortunate the first in which were living with talent and riches and a throne, my sanctuary will dwell and bring in heaven. Then let thy blessing to the immortalized youth on these bright lights and stained felicity, pushing the ominous shadow from their
day.
Thank you.
Against hope, against hope.
So it's very fortunate that you've arrived just at this moment, a special moment of a happy life. So she also asks for the blessing. Or she says, you have the power of blessing to give benign speech, speech that's full of goodwill and generosity, that comes from the higher spheres where there's no grief. So please confirm, say yes to this conjunction of two stars, this blithe conjunction. Blithe is a lovely word, but I don't know quite how to explain it.
It's hail, blithe spirit.
Yeah, hail to thee, blithe spirit, bird thou never wert. It's the first line of a poem by Shelley, to the skylark. Yeah. Blithe.
Intending to be mirthful. That's what it says.
Blithe.
Filled with gladness.
Yes, it's filled with gladness.
Something we hardly never are.
It's carefree. Something that's blithe. There's no care. There's no anxiety. It's free from all that. So this is a blessed, happy meeting of these two stars, these two shining souls, and sanction joy, say yes to their joy with your heavenly voice. And let us not drag in here the danger of our thoughts. We can think, dark suggestions come to us, but we shouldn't speak them out, because our words create those things that we fear. Here there's no reason for any fear, no chance for any grief to raise her threatening head and stare at this love. And very beautifully she says that this Satyavan, he must be one in a million, no? That because Savitri has chosen him. And that's going to be such a happy place, that forest hermitage. She will go and leave her all her luxury, the palace and everything, but there she will live, and she will bring in heaven there to that simple place. So please give your blessing on the unstained felicity. There should be no blot on their happiness of these two bright lives. And if you give your blessing, then that will push away any threatening shadow. This is what she said.
It reminds me of one mother's thing. People ask, they ask for her blessing. She said, it's dangerous to ask for my blessing.
You might not.
I'm working for the best for your soul. You
might not be what you want exactly.
She's doing the same thing here. Careful what you ask for, and you might get it.
Larry, you'll go on.
Too heavy falls the shadow on a man's heart. It dares not be too happy upon earth. It dreads the blow, dogging two vivid joys. A lash unseen in fate's extended hand, the danger lurking in fortune's proud extremes, an irony in life's indulgent smile, and trembles at the laughter of the gods. Or if crouches unseen the panther doom, if wings of evil brood above their house, then also speak, that we may turn aside and rescue our lives from hazard of wayside doom and chance entanglement of an alien fate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything to be explained here? There's this verb dogging. A dog, a good, well-trained dog, follows at your heels.
So barking, annoying.
But the real sense of the word is that it's an inseparable companion. Yeah, something that dogs you. It's always there at your heels. So we human beings, we have the feeling that if we're too extremely happy, then there's bound to be a bad end to it. No?
In this part here also comes the wisdom of the queen forward,
Yes.
To have it for the sorrow and man's heart, And we are thinking about
thinking she's a queen, so she's used to giving orders, so she's telling him what to do.
Isn't she hoping what he
would
do?
She's asking him. She's asking him for a blessing. No, that's what she would like. But if there's a danger, it's also what Aspapati said, no? If you can loose the grip of fate, if you can tell us something that's going to be helpful, then please tell us. And it might be that there's a way out, and then please let us know. We can read one more passage. Marco, you could read.
And Narada's lowly answer to the queen: what help is in provision to the dreamer? Safe doors cry open near, the doomed pass on. A future knowledge is an added pain, a torturing burden, and a fruitless light on the enormous steam that fate has built. The eternal poet, universal mind, has paved each line of his inferior life. Invisible, the giant actor's tread, and man lives like some secret player's mask. He knows not even what his lips shall speak, for a mysterious power compels his steps, and life is stronger than his trembling soul. None can refuse what the stark force demands. Her eyes are fixed upon her mighty aim. No cry or prayer can turn her from her path. She has to lift an arrow from the throat of God.
Thank you. So, what does it help you to see in advance when you can't avoid it? Human beings are driven. It's all decided. And the doors may open to offering you safety, but you will anyway just pass on. You can't help it. There are several nice traditional stories which illustrate that. You want?
Narada is terrible in the sense that he have to give any blessing or something, just beaming them down to the fact that
something
it has to
will something dreadful will happen.
Yeah.
Mm. And it'll only be worse if you know it in advance. In any case, you can't help it, because we're all acting out a drama that's been written by the eternal poet, the universal mind. So he's written out every line. No? And we are not even the actors. The actors are behind. We are just the masks that they are wearing. No? So they are going to speak. We don't know what our words are going to speak. What control do we have? We are being moved. Human beings are being moved by a mysterious power. And life is stronger than our trembling soul, what we fear and what we would like to avoid or prefer. No one, actually, the Greeks believed even the gods could not avoid the force of necessity, the stark force. They would hide their faces when she came into the hall of Olympus. They didn't want her to see them. What do you think, Larry? These last lines, they refer to the stark force.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems to me like he's talking about life, you know, the life force or something, and her trembling soul, as if she's kind of almost like an ordinary human or something, that like ordinary human soul is not strong enough to do anything.
But that refers to man, I think. Yeah. Man lives like some secret player's mask, and life is stronger than his trembling soul. And so we will be overpowered by these actors. But then there are these lines about the stark force. This is fate, this is nature.
I would say the Supreme Shakti is the mother, but for the sake of the drama, he's making it rather grim. He does not able to give the secret that Sri Aurobindo gives, surrender everything to the mother, and then it would be the best possible. He doesn't talk about surrendering to the Supreme Mother.
I think maybe in the Mahabharata, when Krishna shows his dark part, no? And that he's both the light and the dark part. That means both parts bring the development forward. No?
Now, when you see these lines in isolation, you can think they refer to Savitri. You say, her eyes are fixed upon her mighty aim. No cry or prayer can turn her from her path. She has leaped an arrow from the bow of God. But if we see it in the sentence, there's a colon there at the end of line 435, as if these lines refer to the stark force, that strong force which has predetermined how everything is going to work out.
She's an emanation of
that. She is, of course, the Supreme Mother, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So I think we'll stop there for today. Oh yes, let's hear that one. Maybe we have time only for one. Do number seven. Oh, okay. Yeah. One or two.
Thank you. Well, we come to this also. What is fated, and then what might else happen. He seems to say that's not yet decided.
But Ashwapati answered to the seer, as goes the great and golden bounteous stream, flowering by Alakananda's murmuring way, where with enamored speed the waters run, lisping and babbling to the splendor of morn, and cling with lyric laughter round the knees of heaven's daughters, dripping magic rain, pearl bright for moon gold limbs and cloudy air, so are her dawns, like jeweled leaves of light, so cast she her felicity on men. Virgin, who comest perfected by joy, reveal the name thy sudden heartbeat blurt. Whom hast thou chosen, kingliest among men? And Savitri answered with her still calm voice, as one who speaks beneath the eyes of fate, Father and King, I have carried out thy will. One whom I sought, I found in distant lands. I have obeyed my heart, I have heard its call. My Father, I have chosen. This is done. Astonished, all sat silent for a space. Then Ashwapati looked within and saw a heavy shadow float above the name, chased by a sudden and stupendous light. But now the queen, alarmed, lifted her voice. O seer, the bright arrival has been timed. To this high moment of a happy life, hide not from us our doom, if doom is ours. This is the worst and unknown face of fate, a terror ominous, mute, felt more than seen. Behind our seat by day, our couch by night, a fate lurking in the shadows of our hearts. The anguish of the unseen that waits to strike. To know is best, however hard to bear.
Thanks to shopping.
She thought it would do her good.
Right, maybe it will.